From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. For satire on short notice, Russell Baker has few equals in the world of journalism. His Observer column is one of the most popular features in the New York Times. Today, Russell Baker discusses his second memoir, The Good Times, about his life as a young reporter. Also today, we meet Dutch actor Jeroen Krabbé. He's one of his country's premier actors. Now he's making a name in this country in such films as The Living Daylights, Crossing Delancey, and Scandal. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead plays tenor saxophonist Coleman Hawkins' classic version of Body and Soul on the 50th anniversary of its recording. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new detective series Mancuso FBI. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. Americans J. Michael Bishop and Harold Varmus today won the Nobel Prize for Medicine for their discovery of a family of genes that has helped scientists understand how cancer develops. Bishop and Varmus work at the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at the University of California School of Medicine in San Francisco. The 50-member Nobel Committee cited the researchers for their discovery of the cellular origin of retroviral oncogenes. Environmental groups have called on 39 countries meeting in Paris to turn their entire continent, the entire continent of Antarctica, into a wilderness reserve. The call came on the first day of a conference designed to discuss the future of the frozen continent. Roger Moyer reports from Paris.
The countries meeting here have all signed the Washington Treaty of 1959, which regulates who can do what in the Antarctic. So far, this has meant only scientists have gone there to conduct research. The fear now, though, is that the continent could be overrun by tourists or mining and oil companies, all looking for riches. Environmental groups say this would ruin the delicate ecological balance in Antarctica. Today, a coalition of those groups called for the Antarctic to be preserved by prohibiting all mining or oil drilling. They would also like to see large-scale tourism outlawed. France and Australia support this idea, but other countries, like the United States and Britain, argue that some industrial activity could take place under strict environmental safeguards. Over the next 10 days, delegates will try to decide whether the Antarctic is to become the last continent to be exploited for its minerals or the first one to be protected for its nature. For National Public Radio, this is Roger Maurier in Paris.
In Lebanon, as an Arab League ceasefire holds up for another week, children have returned to school today, and the American University of Beirut opened for the first time since March. Mike Theodulu has the story from Nicosia.
That life is returning to normal after 6 months of warfare than the reopening of the schools and the American University of Beirut, once the most prestigious academic institution in the Middle East. The campus overlooking the Mediterranean was bustling with thousands of students, many seeing old friends for the first time in months. There was a shadow over today's celebrations, though. Arab League-sponsored talks between Christian and Muslim deputies in the Saudi Arabian city of Taif are deadlocked. The Muslims want political reforms to precede a Syrian troop withdrawal. The Christians want Syrian troops out before they agree to share power more fairly with the Muslims. Ordinary Lebanese are convinced that if the talks fail, the shelling will begin again. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
The San Francisco Giants beat the Chicago Cubs 3-2 today to win their first National League pennant in 27 years. Will Clark's tie-breaking two-run single in the eighth inning proved to be the difference. The Giants now prepare for the first-ever Bay Area series against the Oakland A's, scheduled to start on Saturday. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 5 points to close at 2791. This is NPR News. Colombia's foreign minister said today the presidents of 7 Latin American nations will study the possibility of an expulsion of Panama from their regional group at a meeting this week. Panama was suspended from the so-called Group of Eight Nations in February of 1988 after General Manuel Noriega deposed elected President Eric Del Valle. The Group of Eight was formed in 1987 to reinforce a return to democracy in Latin America. Police in Colombia's cocaine cartel capital of Medellin say they have foiled a plot to assassinate leading members of the government's Liberal Party. Troops in another part of the country seized a shipment of dynamite, which was being smuggled across the border from neighboring Ecuador. Simon Fisher has more from Bogota.
Police in Medellin reported that they had arrested a couple in possession of weapons and ammunition, including 3 anti-tank rockets, along with plans to assassinate a senator and a Liberal Party presidential candidate. The current war against drug traffickers was launched after the murder of the leading Liberal candidate, Luis Carlos Galan, 2 months ago. Since then, the drug cartels have carried out a campaign of terror throughout the country. Also in Medellin, the local army commander's private secretary was found dead after being kidnapped last week, allegedly by a cartel gang. On the Ecuadorian border, three men were arrested by troops as they attempted to transport a shipment of 175 pounds of dynamite by river. In the capital, Bogota, police said that a bus explosion yesterday, which killed seven passengers, was an accident, not a bomb attack, as some earlier reports had claimed. For National Public Radio, I'm Simon Fisher in Bogota.
Thousands of East German demonstrators marched in Leipzig today, while others held a pro-democracy vigil in East Berlin during East Germany's biggest outbreak of street protest in decades. Before the march, officials of the Leipzig Communist Party reportedly promised they would push for an open dialogue between citizens and the government. Over the weekend, police clubbed pro-democracy protesters in six East German cities. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When Russell Baker was growing up, his mother used to say, "Make something of yourself." He did. He started his career as a reporter for the Baltimore Sun. After working his way up to London bureau chief and White House correspondent, he moved to the New York Times. 8 years later, in 1962, he got his own column, The Observer. His humorous takes on the issues of the day won him national recognition. In 1979, he won a Pulitzer Prize for commentary. Baker won his second Pulitzer in 1982 for his memoir Growing Up, which told how he was shaped by the Depression and by a mother who planned to live out her ambitions through her son. Baker takes his story through the next stage of his life in his current bestseller, The Good Times. It focuses on his years as a reporter from 1947 until 1962, when he became a columnist. I asked Russell Baker which period of his life was easier to put into focus, his childhood or his early career.
It's much easier to deal with childhood. It's because you're so far removed from it. You can look at it with great detachment. It's something that happened a long time ago, and what you remember from it, you remember very clearly, with crystal clarity, but you don't remember a great deal. When I was writing about being a reporter in this book, I was dealing with materials which are swarming in my head. The real problem when you get dealing with that stage of your life is what to discard. You know, you have to leave out almost everything.
Mm-hmm. You have to maybe be more diplomatic too, since you're
talking. To be more diplomatic.
Yeah, you're talking about colleagues here and newspapers and.
of course. That's why that's why the closer you get to the time you write a memoir to your own age, the more lies are built into it. I can be brutally honest with myself as I was at the age of 5, 10, 15. I can be pretty damned honest about the way I was at 25 to 35. But if you ask me about what happened last week, I'll tell you three or four lies. I have to. it's too embarrassing to be absolutely honest about things that are that close to you.
Mm-hmm. When you entered newspaper writing, and this was in the late 1940s, you describe it as not only not a prestigious position, but you describe it as being in the social pit. Did that bother you or bother your mother, who was so ambitious on your behalf?
Oh, no, not at all. You know, my mother regarded newspaper work as honorable work because she'd had this cousin who became managing editor of the New York Times, a man named Edwin James. And she thought that being a newspaper man was a very important work. She thought it was more important than I thought it, as a matter of fact. It was, when I went into newspaper work, I was 22 years old, right out of college, and I had the young person's view of life, that what was worth doing was to do something artistic or creative, as they say these days, terrible word. And I thought that would be writing novels. You know, I wanted to be a great novelist. Newspaper men were hacks to me. They wrote for money, and there's something dishonest about that, artistically dishonest. It lacked integrity. I wanted to be a great novelist. That was where integrity lay. Well, of course, the problem was that I couldn't write a novel, and worse than that, I wasn't even interested in writing a novel. I sat down and tried to write one. It bored me stiff. So I was one of those people who, they're quite common. You find people who want to be great writers, but they don't want to write. I wanted to be a great novelist, but I didn't want to write novels.
Did you love newspapers?
Did I love newspapers?
Yeah. Reading them, or?
Not at first. I got in the habit. Well, I'd always read newspapers since I was a kid. You know, I started reading the comics, and then I'd start reading the news. Used to live in New York and read the Journal American, a Hearst paper. It had wonderful columns, and there was wonderful crime coverage, and I loved crime coverage, particularly back in those days in the 1930s. There were a lot of executions. People were being fried regularly or hung. And I loved reading about the condemned man going to the chair, what he'd eaten for the last meal, and that whole grisly rigmarole.
It's funny that you like that so much, because when you were actually called on to cover a hanging and an electrocution, you did your damnedest to not go.
I certainly did. The thought of having to stand and sit in that penitentiary over in Baltimore and watch some guy drop right in front of my eyes with a rope around his neck was more than I could contemplate. But by that time, I'd been civilized, you see. As a child, you love violence, and something happens to you along the way. You get that civilized out of you.
Russell Baker is my guest, and he's just written a new memoir called The Good Times. It's a sequel to his Pulitzer Prize-winning earlier memoir called Growing Up. Your first work on the newspaper was covering the police beat, and then you ended up on Rewrite. You were surprised that the Rewrite man actually wrote everything in the newspaper, that the reporters didn't do it themselves. Once you were in the position of writing the stories that were phoned in, did you find yourself resorting to newspaper cliches or a lot, or doing your best to get around them and to be as original as possible?
Oh, at first, no. I think you learn all writing by imitating. You know, I really think that you read somebody you admire and you write like that. And then you read somebody else and you try to write like that. You begin writing as a plagiarist. And once I started doing newspaper work, I tried to write the way I conceived newspaper men wrote. So I picked up all this newspaper argot. You know, the hailstones were always as big as golf balls. The rain was all not a rain, it was a deluge. A fire was not a big fire, it was a holocaust. Kids who stuck up cab drivers weren't kids who stuck up cab drivers, they were bandits. Everything was romanticized in this overstated, old-fashioned kind of newspaper lingo. And I've always had a gift for cliché, for aping aping bad English. It came naturally to me. I can say without boasting, because it's certainly nothing to boast about, that I was a very good police rewrite man.
It seems to me that as you became more and more advanced as a reporter, you became more and more aware of the fact that you weren't much interested in politics, government, or the national scene. Is that right?
Well, I'd been, you know, I had nothing but the best assignments. I got off the police rewrite in Baltimore. I was sent to London to be London bureau chief for the Baltimore Sun. I was brought back to be White House correspondent, and then the Times hired me, and I covered presidents, I covered the State Department, I covered the Senate. I ran around with all those guys running for president, Eisenhower, Kefauver, Adlai Stevenson, Jack Kennedy, Nixon. And I was away from home all the time. Meantime, I had three children and a family, and they were growing up without me. But my regular beat as old age began to grip me around the age of 37 was covering the Senate. And I was beginning to question the value of what I was doing. My father, one of the key events of my life, my father died when I was 5 years old. It had a tremendous impact on me. He was 33, died at 33. And I was covering a meeting of the Senate Armed Services Committee in the Senate one day. Closed meeting. We all reporters had to sit outside on the floor, wait for them to come out and posture or distort or lie outright about what had really gone on inside. And it was a long meeting, and I sat there and sat there. And I was 37 years old at that time, and I thought, here I am, 37 years old. When my father was 37, he'd been dead for 4 years. But in his lifetime, He had made something. He was a stonemason. He'd made something you could touch, that people could use, that you could see. And I thought, what am I making? I'm not making anything here. And I thought, instead, I'm sitting here wearing out my hams, waiting for somebody to come out and lie to me. And that was the stage at which I think I was finally grown up. That was the last moment of being young. And after that, it was a very quick transition out of reporting.
You're saying doesn't make complete sense to me, because, okay, maybe your father was making something more tangible, but you certainly made made an impact in reporting. I don't really understand why you needed it. As a writer, you know, why you needed something like more tangible.
I had become scared about reporting. I had lost my faith in reporting, that reporting was a worthy way for a grown man to spend his life, because I thought it's so difficult to get it right, and particularly when you get beyond police-type things. Sure, you can get the name of the dead person right and how many bullets are in the body, but when you get to covering the Senate, the questions are so subtle that often you don't even know what the right question is to ask. And the more I understood about reporting world events and national events and politics, the more it seemed to me that it was impossible ever to get it right, that all you could be was a transmission belt for deception.
Was it the deception war that was really bothering you?
Well, I didn't, you know, I had come into journalism when I adapted to it believing that what was worthy about it was telling people what happened yesterday. I have sort of a school teacher's yen to make people understand, to see. And that's what I wanted to do in journalism. Other than if you couldn't do that, it wasn't worth doing, I thought. And I felt that I had discovered that you couldn't do it. Therefore, you know, I wasn't making something that was useful, as my father had done.
You spent the first part of your career at the Baltimore Sun and then moved over to the New York Times, first to cover the White House beat. And you didn't seem to like that very much, judging from your book. And it seemed that there were so many people covering everything from the Times that there wasn't always enough work to do. And there were sometimes too many reporters on a story, you felt.
Yeah, but you must remember that when I came to the White House, I had been in London for a year and a half, 2 years, whatever. And London, I'd gone to London at 27 as a correspondent for The Sun. And they offered me the job covering the White House. Then I switched over to the Times. Well, it sounds glamorous. It's wonderful you're going to be the White House correspondent. You know, it's top of the world, Ma, right? Everybody wants to be White House correspondent. Well, I checked into the White House the first day over there, and it took me about 36 hours to realize I'd made one of the world's great mistakes. I had sacrificed London for the honor of sitting in this sealed room listening to White House correspondents snore. Absolutely nothing went on. You know, you were given press releases periodically, and you took them back to the office and typed them out. A copy boy could have done the work. But you had your name on page one every day. Well, that was my experience at The Sun. Scotty Reston came along, hired me to The Times, and promised I wouldn't have to. He would take me off the White House. I had to go up to New York first and worked in that enormous city room of the New York Times, where they had so many people that the city editor had a loudspeaker system. He summoned the staff to the city desk over a series of amplifiers hung through the city room. I felt utterly lost. And somebody said, don't be alarmed. People were sitting around playing bridge. There was a running bridge game. Other people were doing the crossword puzzle. It looked like people who hadn't done anything for weeks. And somebody said, the Times always likes to be well-staffed in case the Titanic sinks. They've got enough reporters to cover it. So I went back to Washington, and pretty soon Scotty Reston had me covering the White House again. There was no escaping Washington.
I want to talk with you about how you got out of reporting and into writing a column, but first we're going to take a short break. My guess is Journalist and humorist Russell Baker, who's written a new memoir, which is called The Good Times. It's a sequel to Growing Up. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest Russell Baker writes the Observer column in the New York Times, and he has a new memoir titled Good Times, which picks up where his Pulitzer Prize-winning earlier autobiography, Growing Up, left off. You went from reporting to writing a column at the New York Times. You were almost wooed away by the Baltimore Sun, but the Times made you a counteroffer to stay, and they offered you a column there. When you started writing the column, did you start writing it humorously at the very beginning?
No, I had no idea what it was going to be. I had never thought of writing a column that would be humorous, that anybody would call it humorous. I incidentally still don't think of it as a humor column, but it certainly wasn't conceived in those terms. I really didn't have any clear idea what I was going to do, but I thought it was going to be a casual essay kind of column. A casual column, as they say, and what I was firm about was that the diction would be primarily an Anglo-Saxon kind of English rather than Latin English. For example, I would say use instead of utilize. I would say do instead of implement. And I thought I would write it in simple English prose, very direct, and it would be casual. And that's what I did for several weeks. Just whatever came along in the news, I would comment on copying some of the style that I'd discovered E.B. White doing in the old Talk of the Town in the New Yorker. And after several weeks, Time Magazine's press section had a piece saying there is a humorist at the Times, and it turned out to be about me, and I was astonished, also a little appalled, because I hadn't thought I was doing humor. And I concluded finally that, anything that was in plain English at the Times in those days must seem funny.
Once you started writing the column, did you get out of the house very much? I mean, you used to be on a beat where you had to be out and reporting all the time.
Yeah, the hardest thing about going from reporting to a column is the discovery that as a columnist, if you have a fact, you're in trouble. A column is a reflection of a mind, that's all. Of a mind that's confronted with certain data that everybody else is confronted with. Is it an interesting mind, a dull mind, an extraordinary mind, a weird mind? The column will reveal that. But it's not a business of conveying information. And when I first took it on, I couldn't get out of the habit of going to fires. I'd go to the White House, I'd go to the Senate, I'd go to the State Department, wherever the story of the day was. I was there taking notes and coming back and trying to turn it into a column. And I had a good friend who sat across the aisle. Every once in a while, I'd show him one and say, "What do you think?" And he'd shake his head, "No." And he said, "It's not a column, it's reporting." So it was a terribly difficult transition. And of course, because in American journalism, you're trained to keep yourself, to keep your personality out of what you write. It's very difficult to get in the habit of suffusing whatever you're writing with your personality, which you must do to make a column successful. If the column doesn't express your personality or some aspect of it very forcefully, it won't succeed.
My guest is columnist Russell Baker, who's written a new memoir called The Good Times. I want to go back in time a little bit to a subject that you've written about in both of your memoirs, and that's the subject of your mother. In both of your books, you've written about her ambition for you to become something and for you to never be a quitter. How do you think that drive both helped and perhaps hurt you?
Well, that's a very old American thing. I guess even today you're supposed to make something of yourself, aren't you? That was my mother's message. If you work hard, you make something of yourself. You apply yourself. You'll be somebody. You'll make something of yourself. Well, it gets translated very quickly into making a lot of money. That's commonly what happens because somebody said, William Hamilton, I think, said, in America, money is life's report card. How do you know you've made something of yourself if you don't have the money to show it? So I had been marinated in this approach to life. You had to make something of yourself. So, or as the sociologists would say these days, I was intensely success-oriented. I pursued success with great zeal and vigor. And I was successful. In a way, this book is about being successful when young. And what happens at the end, what I discovered was that that day sitting in the Senate corridor, growing up, if you will, that being successful wasn't enough. There was more to it than that. And when I reached that stage, 36, 37, it was necessary to have another look at myself and see if there wasn't more to life than being successful.
And what did you find?
Well, I don't know. That's the next book. After success, what?
Well, do you know yet? I mean, will you find out when you write the book what the answer to that question is?
Of course. I mean, how do I know what I think if I haven't written it first?
You know?
Writing is thinking, you know.
By the time you're in your 30s, I guess, in your new book, you've become a pretty good drinker. Was that ever a problem for you?
No, I didn't have... alcoholism?
Mm-hmm.
No. I drank because it was what you did in to be a newspaper man when I came into the business. I smoked 2 packs of cigarettes a day, and I didn't drink every day, but, you know, I drank on every occasion when you had time to drink. I was afraid to drink on the job, never drank on the job, because I discovered very quickly if you drank, you couldn't write. You know, you thought you were writing brilliantly, and then you saw it the next day, and you discovered you'd made a fool of yourself.
Did your mother ever feel that there were consequences that her ambitions had that she hadn't counted on? For instance, when her health started failing, you were, I believe, in Europe or something on assignment. I mean, that your success made it difficult for you to spend as much time with her as she probably would have liked.
Oh, I don't think that bothered her, no. No, you know, of course, my mother lived to be a very old age. She, relatively old, it doesn't seem as old as it used to. She died at 87. This book ends with her funeral, in fact. She was 87 by that time and had been hopelessly senile for 6 years. But to that time, she had never indicated that she wanted to spend more time with me. It wasn't that that she wanted. What she wanted was something to talk about to the neighbors. You know, it's so typical. It's like a bad story. She would bore the neighbors to death with tales of her son, the columnist or the White House correspondent or whatever. But when she saw me, it was always, this isn't good enough. You know, if you work at this White House job, you might really make something of yourself. If you work at this column, you might make something of yourself.
Mm-hmm. Ever still have dreams about writing that novel?
No, I have no interest in writing fiction. I discovered journalism shown me that the world that's right in front of my eyes is so much more interesting and complex than any my imagination is capable of creating that it would be foolish for me to try fiction. I just don't have the gift for it. Fiction's a special gift and requires a special kind of commitment that I have no interest. I just couldn't do that.
Russell Baker, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Baker's current bestseller is The Good Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. That's Benny Goodman playing Body and Soul. It's one of the standards in the jazz repertoire. The version recorded 50 years ago by Coleman Hawkins is considered a masterpiece. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead celebrates the anniversary. Jeroen Krabbe is a well-known Dutch actor, but every time Hollywood gave a call, it was to play a heavy with a foreign accent. Coming up, Jeroen Krabbe talks about his more recent roles in Crossing Delancey and Scandal. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Mancuso FBI, with Robert Loggia playing an FBI detective. It's a spin-off of last year's TV miniseries, Favorite Son. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. There are reports today that the U.S. would keep producing chemical weapons during a 10-year phase-out of a treaty currently being negotiated in Geneva. NPR's Phyllis Crockett has more on the story.
Last month, President Bush said he wanted to ban all chemical weapons, but he didn't say when the U.S. would stop production. The assumption was that production would stop once a treaty was signed, although a certain percentage would be stockpiled until all weapons were destroyed at the end of the 10-year period. Elisa Harris of the Brookings Institution says the new proposal gives countries an incentive to begin producing the weapons before the treaty is concluded.
It just simply doesn't make sense, for, on the one hand, to be signing a treaty for the elimination of weapons and at the same time to be permitting countries to continue producing the weapons.
The new proposal would mean a change in the draft treaty. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
Pro-Syrian Lebanese leader Nabi Berri said today in Beirut that there will be no Syrian pullout until the last Israeli soldier leaves southern Lebanon. He made the comment after new talks with Iranian leaders. The presence of Syrian troops in Lebanon remains a key bone of contention among Christian and Muslim lawmakers now meeting in Saudi Arabia. Hungary's new Socialist Party has elected a new leader and a 25-member ruling body. And afterward, their first telegram of congratulations arrived from the Soviet Union. This weekend, Hungary's communists transformed themselves into a Western-style Socialist Party. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
The new president of Hungary's new Socialist Party is a longtime reformer. He's also chairman of the former Communist Party. Rezun Yej was elected by an overwhelming majority today in a closed session in what's been a remarkably open party congress. He's joined by a 25-member ruling body that contains mostly reformers and their supporters, but also enough centrists to keep the party together. Now, Hungary's new Socialist Party will have to convince Hungary's voters that the communists have changed. In a news conference tonight, the new party leader said the first telegram of congratulations came from Mikhail Gorbachev. It arrived, he said, 2 hours after the election, delivered by the Soviet ambassador in Budapest. This is Deborah Amos reporting.
In Washington, Pentagon officials say the armed services newspaper Stars and Stripes will be run by civilians in the future. Editions of the military publication in both Europe and the Pacific have been plagued in recent years by allegations of censorship and, in some cases, worker harassment. The U.S. X Corporation said today that it has sold all of its equity interest in South African companies. The Pittsburgh-based company says it formerly used minerals from the companies involved, but no longer finds them essential as a supplier. On Wall Street, another record-high closing as the Dow Jones Industrials moved up almost 6 points to close at 2,791. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Wednesday is the 50th anniversary of a milestone in jazz, tenor saxophonist Coleman Hawkins' recording of Body and Soul. Hawkins was the first great tenor saxophonist. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says he was the best ever. Right up to his death in 1969, Hawkins insisted that people always made too much of Body and Soul, that he played that great all the time. Kevin says there's more than a little truth to that, but that Body and Soul was extraordinary even for Hawkins.
That's Coleman Hawkins as he sounded on October 11th, 1939, at the start of a recording session that produced his greatest masterpiece, his first version of Johnny Green's Body and Soul. Jazz musicians had always been fond of the tune. Louis Armstrong recorded it in 1930, the year it was written. Benny Goodman did it in 1935, a year after Hawkins had sailed for Europe, where he stayed for 5 years. When Coleman Hawkins returned to New York in August of 1939, he was eager to hear what other tenor saxophonists were up to, and they were eager to hear him. Hawkins had been the acknowledged master of the tenor before 1934, but his absence from the American scene had eroded his position. In New York, the new boss of the tenor was his disciple Chu Berry, who'd recorded his well-received version of Body and Soul in 1938. After 5 years away, Coleman Hawkins was disappointed by the players he heard in New York, Chu Berry included. He said they all sounded the same as they had before he left. Hawkins himself had been experimenting with new approaches to harmony that anticipated the bebop movement of the 1940s. Hawkins liked to denigrate his own version of Body and Soul, said that he had to be forced into recording it. But the reason he'd been asked to do it at all was that it was a highlight of his live shows, pointedly enough given Chu Berry's association with it. Hawkins' three-minute improvisation was a compressed version of the long ones he did live. It's beautifully constructed, from its murmuring opening to its operatic climax. As a kid, Hawkins played cello, and you can hear the influence of that stately instrument in his solo conception. All right, enough talk. Here's Coleman Hawkins on Body and Soul, October 11th, 1939. Thank you. Coleman Hawkins cut Body and Soul in one take and walked out of the studio without listening back to it. A few weeks later, he was sitting in a bar when it came on the radio. He had to admit, it sounded pretty good. The public agreed. It sold 100,000 copies in its first year of release. Not bad for jazz, then or now. It could still be found on jukeboxes in the 1950s. Hawkins always said he was amused by people who'd compliment him on playing such a pretty melody on Body and Soul. There was very little of the original tune left in his version. But of course, Hawkins had created a striking melody of his own as he weaved his way through Johnny Green's intricate chords. That's how he created an artistic masterpiece that became an instant commercial hit.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. This is Coleman Hawkins on a 1940 recording of My Blue Heaven. The trombonist is J.C. Higginbottom. This is Fresh Air. Jeroen Krabbe is one of Holland's leading stage and film actors. He starred in Paul Verhoeven's hit films Soldier of Orange and The Fourth Man. He's known to international audiences for his leading role as a Soviet general in the 1987 James Bond film The Living Daylights. American film audiences will also recognize him as the egotistical émigré writer who seduces Amy Irving in the film Crossing Delancey. In the recent film Scandal, which comes out this month on home video, Krabbe is again cast as a Russian. He plays Captain Eugene Ivanov, a Soviet diplomat who's involved with Christine Keeler while she's having an affair with John Profumo, the British Minister of War. In this scene, Krabbe, as the Soviet diplomat, is driving Keeler home from a party.
You know what I see when I look at this country? Doom, decay, a land without honor.
Not that bad.
You saw this Profumo, you saw what he did. He was walking on the bottom at the shallow end. What kind of man is this?
You're just angry because he beat you.
He cheated. He was walking on the bottom. He's a cabinet minister and he cheats at games.
Now, you play a Russian in Scandal.
Yeah.
Have you found that in some English-speaking movies that when you're not... When you're from a country other than America or England, that you can be cast as a foreigner from any number of countries?
Yeah, that's true. Because, for instance, for Crossing the Landsea, my character started off as a Yugoslavian, then I was a Greek, then it turned to an Italian, then a French guy, and finally we ended up me playing a Dutch guy, which I am, so that was quite nearby. But they, you know, especially in America, they could cast you for so many things because they think people from Europe, they're all the same, which is not true, of course, but they cast you for a Scandinavian or an Italian or, you know, that sort of thing. But it broadens the whole thing for me. I mean, it's the whole field is quite wide, the spectrum for which they ask me. So it's an advantage.
Now, the role you played in Crossing Delancey.
Yeah.
Was of an émigré literary star who's very narcissistic, very sexist.
Yeah. It has nothing to do with me.
Yeah, I'm sure. And this character always likes to have a woman around who's going to be the private secretary and
right,
the lover
right.
And cater to his every wish.
Didn't you like him?
Oh, well...
He was kind of a jerk, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. But it was a great portrayal, I thought. I mean, I recognized the character right away.
Yeah, that's what all the women say.
Well, I was wondering if you had a person in mind to pattern it on. I mean, I'm not asking you to name names.
Friends of mine, yeah, absolutely. No, I don't mention any names, but I know those guys. I'm not like that at all. In a way, I'm quite dull. I'm married for 23 years. I have 3 kids. I'm a cook. I cook at home. I do some ironing and cleaning, yeah, that sort of thing. So I'm quite a dull guy, and I'm not at all that guy that I portrayed in Crossing the Lands. But I know a couple of macho guys, despicable macho guys, and I portrayed this character after them.
You should thank me. For not calling you in the middle of the night. I've been in this new work now for a while, and I haven't shown it to anyone. And it would be utterly self-destructive to give it to my editor at this point, but it feels, I don't know, but it might be very, good. So there I was at 3 in the morning or something, wishing very hard for a gentle reader, and I thought of you.
I don't know what to say.
You're, flattered.
I'm flattered?
You're, intrigued.
I'm intrigued.
And you'll come over now, and I'll show you this damn thing so I can find out if there's anything there.
I can't tonight.
Let him wait. They love to be kept waiting. You see, please.
Now, you're from the Netherlands.
I am.
And is there much of a Dutch film industry, and was there when you started?
No, when I started, there wasn't anything at all. I mean, there were a couple of movie makers who were quite old and who made documentaries, good documentaries, but not really good features. And then all of a sudden, Paul Verhoeven came along, and he made Turkish Delight and Keetje Tippel and Spetters, and then he asked me to for A Soldier of Orange, which was a big, huge hit. And then he made A Fourth Man with me. And in a period of 10 years' time, Paul was the leading guy in Dutch cinema. And when he left, because when he had such success with all these movies, he was asked by Hollywood. And so he went to Hollywood, and he lives there now, and he's making this new Schwarzenegger movie after RoboCop. And so when Paul left, there were a couple of people still there in Holland who were quite interesting, but I thought that really the heart was sort of out of this body, you know. And I felt quite lost without Paul, because he was my mentor. He was the guy I really looked at and as an absolutely extraordinary movie maker. So, but for an actor, it's always more difficult to go to another country because you have to speak the language. And the director, he could have whatever accent, but for an actor, it's difficult. So finally, after The Fourth Man, they asked me, and I came to the United States, and it's going quite well.
Since there's no film industry, there wasn't film school to go to.
No.
Do you feel that that was an advantage or a disadvantage?
It's a disadvantage, of course. And Paul wasn't really able to work with actors. He knew exactly what movie he wanted to have. He couldn't explain that properly. So what we did is absolutely... Well, to Americans, it's silly. But we were shooting without direct sound, so he was screaming through all the scenes to achieve what he wanted to see. You know, when he was screaming like, I don't want to see that, just go to your right, do that, do it again, and that sort of thing. And sometimes when I see Soldier of Orange, when I see it back, I see myself reacting not to my fellow actor, but to the director who was shouting from the other side of the camera. And then I haven't seen Paul. I didn't work with him for a couple of years. And then in The Fourth Man, which was 5 years later, I guess, he had changed completely. And he even he started to rehearse with me first. And we've been talking a lot. But sometimes in the middle of the shoot, he had some of those days that he started to shout again at me. And, well, I was used to it, you know. But that's funny.
So in those early movies, that meant that you had to dub in the sound.
Yeah, we dubbed the whole of Soldier of Orange was dubbed, every line in it. Yeah.
Did you hate doing that?
Oh, yeah. But I'm very good at it, thank God, because I had to do it for weeks on end. And I learned the craft of dubbing there, actually, because we had to do it, all of us. Even me, I remember walking through the sea, and I had this little top, you know, in front of me, and I had to dive into the sea, so I dived several times into this top in front of the microphone, which was quite funny, and running everything we did, everything we dubbed. Yeah.
I'm wondering if you've seen your movies with other actors dubbing in your part, you know, movies that aren't subtitled.
No, I haven't. No, no, no. I don't want to, because I know that The Fourth Man is dubbed by someone else. Uh-huh. I did the for instance, the James Bond German dubbing, I did myself, because I speak German as well. So I went to Munich and did the dubbing there, because I didn't want to give it away to someone else, because I thought, oh, you know, it's not my voice, and it's going to make it duller or at least different from what I should do. And The Fourth Man is dubbed by someone. I always wondered why they didn't ask me to do that, because I could have, of course, an accent in it, because he's a Dutch guy, right?
Uh-huh.
And but they never asked me, and I never want to see it. Some people have it on tape. They said to me, well, you have to see it one day. I said, no, I will not, because I can't stand it. I can't stand it, because I did it. I went through all the emotions, and I went through all the things. And not another actor could feel whatever I felt there. So maybe he did a good job. I don't know, but I haven't seen it.
Let me ask you, when someone comes up to you in America and recognizes you...
Yeah, which happens a lot here in New York, for instance.
Well, are you not sure whether they're going to recognize you as the villain from the James Bond movie?
No, it's the
Russian spy
Delancey.
Scandal, or Crossing Delancey. So you don't know whether their image of you is going to be as a...
No, because I look very much like the character in Crossing Delancey. I didn't change my hairdo or my clothes even. I'm even wearing my own jacket. And the other characters, to look a bit different, you know. That's why they say, oh, I know your face. I've seen you in Crossing Delancey. And, it's more or less Crossing Delancey, yeah.
Okay, well, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Dutch actor Jeroen Krabbé. He's featured in the film Scandal, which comes out on home video this month. Fresh air. Time to check in with All Things Considered and see what's coming up. Hi, Linda Wertheimer.
Hi there, Terry. We're looking again at East Germany and at the reaction, the very strong reaction there yesterday to demonstrations. We've been talking to a church leader in East Berlin, and we'll be getting back in touch with him again. We also have a long piece by our commentator, Verda Mae Grosvenor, who returned to the Barrier Islands of South Carolina to see how people there are doing and how they're recovering from Hurricane Hugo. We have the Nobel Prizes for Medicine. And we're going to spend a little time exploring that Gallup survey that discovered that a large number of college seniors don't know what century Columbus discovered America.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. One year ago, NBC presented Favorite Son, a miniseries about political intrigue in Washington. Robert Loggia, as FBI agent Nick Mancuso, was one of the supporting players in that drama and proved so popular that the actor and the character are being spun off into their own series this week. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
I really liked Robert Loggia's character in Favorite Son. He wasn't the star, but he sure shone like one. He was this burned-out, ready-to-retire FBI agent assigned to a controversial murder case, assigned by crooked FBI executives who expected him not to solve it, but just go through the motions. But instead, Mancuso's idealism and patriotism and the death of his partner spurred him on to crack the case and pretty much save democracy single-handed. At the end of the Favorite Son miniseries, the president himself asked Mancuso to stay on and undertake special assignments for the FBI. So here, one year later, is the result. A weekly series called Mancuso FBI, with the same pecking order as in almost all TV cop and detective shows. Even though these guys solve the toughest cases week after week, their bosses always yell at them.
You are a dinosaur. You are a hangover in a $10 suit. You got your last partner killed.
What? What did you say?
If you blow this gig, or if I find out that you leaked, you might as well just crawl in a box with them. And one more word, you are out on a park bench, mister.
Mancuso FBI is the last of the season's new fall shows to premiere, and I'd really like to say that it's worth the wait, but I can't. The plot in the pilot episodes takes a few nice twists, but the dialogue sounds like it's ripped, or ripped off, from a cheap detective novel. Here, for example, is the way Mancuso tries to get the name of a confidential source from a local TV anchorwoman he knows.
Yeah. How'd you find her?
She found me. Can I help it if the little people think of me as Washington's one-woman wailing wall?
You got an address?
No.
That wasn't a question.
Good reporters never reveal their sources.
How would you know?
Gestapo.
Muckraker.
Fascist.
Bimbo.
Nazi.
Talk show host.
Now that was a low blow.
It was also a bad scene. Not even Loggia can do anything with lines that forced. But what he can do is bring life and passion to the little soliloquies that made Mancuso such a hit in Favorite Son. If anything makes Mancuso FBI worth sitting through, it's those moments when Loggia revs his engines and takes off. Here he is facing down the boss who had yelled at him earlier.
When you were out in the field, you were a big case man, a producer. And then you get promoted to Washington, you get stars in your eyes. You think that by playing politics and giving favors that you're going to get yourself a corner office at headquarters. Well, it doesn't work that way. So what we do isn't about politics. It's about right and wrong. You start playing politics, and you're going to end up like Pat Gray or Ollie North. And the same guys who are buying favors from you are going to cut your throat. You got the best job in the world. You get to defend the Constitution, and you get paid for it. The rules in Washington are no different from anywhere else, except the stakes are higher. Now, are you going to talk, or am I going to go to the director and relieve myself all over your career plan?
As political dramas go, it's more credible and watchable than the two other TV dramas set in Washington this year, Top of the Hill and Snoops. But if the scripts don't improve quickly, Mancuso FBI may wish he had retired after the Favorite Son case. At least then, he would have retired with honor.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, Ron Barron, and Dan Lachlan. Our director is Audrey Voblaitis. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Buck Henry talks about guest hosting Saturday Night Live, writing the screenplay for The Graduate, and co-creating the TV spy spoof Get Smart. And British crime writer Ruth Rendell reveals how she comes up with her surprise endings. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.